he will probably fully recover from his wounds, but they were very severe and he was hurt badly.
Anchorage police are still looking for suspects in the police officer shooting over the weekend. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 11th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the city of Dillingham decides to refuse money from the Pebble Mine developers.
I, for one, am not willing to sell out my heritage and my cultural values for material goods.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This afternoon, the Anchorage Police Department issued an update on its search for suspects in the early Saturday morning shooting of APD officer Jason Allen. Also today, the police union announced it was offering a several thousand dollar reward for the arrest and successful prosecution of the suspects in the shooting. KSKA's Len Anderson has more.
The drive-by shooting, which Anchorage police describe as an ambush, took place just before 2 o'clock Saturday morning. Officer Jason Allen had returned to his police car after dealing with a domestic situation in the city's Fairview neighborhood. As he was working on his report, a car pulled up beside him, and without warning or a single word, someone in the vehicle opened fire on Allen, hitting him on the arms and torso. Police spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says even after being shot, Allen continued to radio information about the suspects to fellow officers until help arrived.
It is not something that comes naturally. He acted on his training and experience in this situation and did a marvelous job.
Parker says Allen is responding to treatment.
We're thrilled at the news that he will probably fully recover from his wounds, but they were very severe and he was hurt badly.
Police say they still have no suspects, but in today's update, they listed a trio of enforcement groups now helping them. Parker says they include the Alaska State Troopers, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Seattle Police Department.
Seattle Police Department had a recent event which was very similar to this. On October 31st, two of their officers were fired upon by a vehicle in a very similar manner. Their experiences in solving that crime and dealing with it have been very helpful and will continue to be helpful for our detectives because this is a rather rare occurrence.
Besides Seattle, there subsequently were two other similar shootings in nearby Pierce County and Tacoma. Altogether, six officers were killed. The Anchorage police are seeking information from the public. Parker says that in addition to knowing that the suspects were out Saturday at 2 a.m., there are other possible clues.
Those things include the fact that these suspects were out on the streets at 2 a.m. on Saturday morning. They were in a dark-colored sedan, believed to be an early 90s model. Also, we want to encourage the public to let us know if there is anyone that people know of who have been threatening or have threatened or voiced hatred of police officers or judicial officials, made threats to harm those individuals, especially within the last few days or weeks.
Parker says several people have called in tips, which the police are looking into. And this afternoon, the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association announced it's offering at least a $10,000 reward for information and assistance leading to the arrest and prosecution of the guilty parties. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A Sitka grand jury has indicted a woman on murder charges some 22 years after the crime allegedly took place. 45-year-old Jane Lim faces charges of first-degree murder and tampering with evidence in the death of her then-husband, Scott Coville. According to the indictment, Coville died on or about April 12, 1988. what would have been his 26th birthday. Lim, who was 24 when the crime took place, is charged with killing Coville and disposing of the body. The case is being prosecuted by Assistant Attorney General and Cold Case Prosecutor Pat Gullifson. Gullifson says Coville's body has never been recovered and that authorities know Lim's whereabouts.
The next step would be when she is in custody, she would be brought back to the state of Alaska and appear before the court in Sitka to be arraigned on the charges. We don't know when that will be, when she will appear in court in Sitka, because she is, we need to make contact with her.
Gullifson says Coville's murder case was reopened after unsolicited information was given to authorities. He declined to give any details of the murder, saying he didn't want to risk tainting a Sitka jury pool. But Gullifson said advances in DNA technology were helpful in getting the indictment against Lim. Senator Mark Begich met with the press this morning in Anchorage to recap the last congressional session and to outline the federal administration's priorities for the coming year. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Begich told a handful of reporters that the Obama administration faced a full agenda a year ago as the country started its work of fighting out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. Begich said the national stimulus bill has provided $1.5 billion to Alaska, the highest per capita spending in the nation.
We estimate the stimulus bill at this point has produced about $1.5, $1.6 billion in expenditures and obligations to Alaska, and I believe we'll see about 65% or so of that money being spent starting this spring.
He pointed to raises for military personnel and to $300 million in secure funding for military projects in an appropriations bill which will finance several military construction projects throughout the state. But the thorny issue of health care reform remains. Begich says it's 90% complete, although the final legislation with the Senate Conference Committee. Some want the committee's debate on national television. 40 Republicans, including Senator Lisa Murkowski, have signed a letter to Majority Leader Harry Reid urging that negotiations be conducted in public.
The question is, in the Conference Committee, should that be public? My view is sure. Let the public see that. I mean, it's like making sausage. I'm not sure they want to see it, but so be it. I mean, I think the more the public is engaged in the actual truth about the health care bill, I think the more they'll be supportive of it.
Begich says he's getting thousands of comments from Alaskans on the health care bill. He says a Medicare reimbursement plan still has to be worked out, but so far he believes the bill is a step forward.
Will there be tweaks in the future? Absolutely. Is it a perfect bill? No. But it doesn't move us to controlling and getting management over these insurance companies and what they've been doing to the public? Yes. Does it increase coverage to people? Yes. Does it get rid of the issues that I hear generally about, pre-existing conditions, caps, and those things? Absolutely.
Begich has written to Senator Reid himself expressing his concerns about an excise tax on health insurance plans and added restrictions on employer responsibility. Begich says health care, energy, and the budget will dominate the administration's agenda this year. He says the president's budget is anticipated to contain a significant component dealing with the national deficit. Begich works on deficit issues with 10 other Democrats. In issues closer to home, the senator applauded NOAA's extension of a public comment period regarding critical habitat for the Cook Inlet beluga whale.
I think it will have an impact. When I was mayor, we were concerned about the impact to the port as well as to our wastewater treatment facility. And I think there is more research to be done, and the designation is premature.
Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young joined Begich in requesting the extension. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Former Governor Sarah Palin has a deal with Fox News. The network says Palin has a multi-year contract and will be contributing political commentary and analysis across all Fox News platforms. She will also host periodic episodes of a new program called Real American Stories. Fox describes the show as a series exploring inspirational real-life tales of overcoming adversity throughout the American landscape. The network didn't announce terms of the deal. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new museum opens in Kotzebue.
People seem to like it already. They seem to be taking some ownership of it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
And by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network. APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
The U.S. Department of Defense announced that a soldier assigned to Fort Richardson has been killed in Afghanistan. The department says Sergeant First Class Jason Hickman of Tennessee died January 7th when enemy forces attacked his unit with an improvised explosive device and small arms fire. He was 35 years old and arrived in Alaska in May of 2008. The deadline for filing sex abuse claims against the bankrupt Society of Jesus Northwest Province has passed. The Oregon-based Jesuits provided clergy to Western Alaska villages throughout past decades when abuse is alleged to have occurred. Anchorage attorney Ken Rosa, who represents many abuse victims, says about 350 of the 500 claimants are from Alaska, but some have already settled their cases.
The Jesuits have settled almost 150 claims over the past 7 or 8 years for Alaskan victims and have paid about just under $60 million. So with another 200 claims pending, we expect an amount of money that would be proportionate to what they paid to the previous 150 or so claimants.
That amount would be worked out in bankruptcy court based on an assessment of the Jesuits' remaining assets. The Dillingham City Council passed a resolution last week that precludes the city from applying for or accepting money from a charitable fund created by the partnership developing the Pebble Mine. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Last month, the Dillingham City Council refused to take up a resolution that would have accepted over $41,000 from the Pebble Fund to pay for engineering and design of a roof for the outdoor hockey rink that's located next to the public safety building. During Thursday night's meeting, the council was urged by area resident Ron Bowers to accept the money.
Mayor Ruby recently testified before the governor's rural cabinet that per capita, Dillingham is one of the most taxed communities in Alaska. We're currently paying down $15 million school bond to the tune of over $1 million a year. We do not have any budgetary wiggle room. We cannot afford to pass up $41,000 of free money with no strings attached, no matter where it comes from. Emotionalism does not pay the bills.
Not only did the Dillingham City Council not accept the grant money from the Pebble Fund, they passed a resolution stipulating that the city would never accept or apply for money from the Pebble Fund. Another member of the public who testified Thursday night was Karen McCambly, who supported the resolution and its larger message.
I, for one, am not willing to sell out my heritage and my cultural values for material goods. And I really do appreciate what you guys are doing to protect the region and to protect Dillingham, because I think that we all need to recognize and remember that this is a fishing community and that the fish and the clean water are what keeps us here, and that's what our community is based upon.
When the resolution was brought to the floor, Councilman Keggy Tubbs successfully amended it to stipulate that the City Council not apply for or accept funding from the Pebble Fund because of its relationship to the Pebble Partnership.
You can't oppose what they stand for on one hand and then take money from them in another.
Back in April of 2006, the Dillingham City Council approved a resolution not just opposing the proposed Pebble Mine, but all large-scale mining in the watershed. The lone city council member to vote in opposition to the new resolution was Tim Sands.
If it was a brand new fire truck that we were getting, I would have a very hard time turning that down, because we have big needs in this community. So I can't just out of hand not accept any money that we could potentially use in this community.
The final vote was 5-1 in favor of the resolution, which in essence precludes the city from participating in the Pebble Fund. However, it was only a resolution, which does not have the power to bind future city councils. The Pebble Fund was created in early 2008 with a $5 million contribution from the Pebble Partnership. The fund is under the direction of the Alaska Community Foundation, and it's managed by an independent advisory board made up of stakeholders from communities and organizations spread across the entire Bristol Bay region. The president of that advisory committee is Billy Maines from Dillingham, who was appointed to that committee by the city of Dillingham.
It baffles me to no end when there's a pot of money that all you have to do is ask for it, and more times than not you can get it just by asking for it. And there's no strings attached.
So far, the Pebble Fund has awarded around $1.6 million to over 50 projects in the Bristol Bay region, including around $85,000 that has been given to the Dillingham City School District. Grant applications to the Pebble Fund are currently being accepted with a cutoff date of February 26th. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
An independent federal agency will investigate allegations that the Forest Service retaliated against a whistleblower employee on the Petersburg Ranger District of the Tongass National Forest. The Office of Special Counsel is reopening the case of Glenn Eath, a Forest Service biologist who died in 2008. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The Office of Special Counsel said it was resuming the investigation this month in response to a request from a national organization that had helped Glenn Eath with his original whistleblower claims. In a letter to Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics, or FC, Associate Special Counsel Leonard Drabinski writes that he's reopening the Eath case for further investigation. The OSC is tasked with enforcing federal law that protects whistleblowers from reprisals. According to Drabinski, the agency plans to, quote, determine if prohibited personnel practices were committed against Mr. Eath and if disciplinary action is appropriate against any individual involved. An OSC spokesperson said the agency could not comment on an open investigation. FC Director Andy Stahl says the OSC's decision to reopen the case is unusual.
OSC does retaliatory cases in which they go after the retaliators very infrequently. In fact, OSC has not done one in at least 29 years. To reopen a case to go after retaliators, we think is unique. To reopen a case against retaliators who took action against an environmental whistleblower is definitely unique. It's never been done in history.
And Stahl says the scope of this case will likely be unique because of the high rank of the officials involved. Stahl accuses Tongass Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole and a number of other officials in Alaska and the lower 48 of reassigning and suspending Eath and ultimately terminating his job because he had blown the whistle on illegal road building activity. The Forest Service has denied these allegations in the past. Eath's superiors said they were disciplining him for other reasons. They eventually told him they were eliminating his job because of budget cuts. The OSC originally began looking into the Forest Service actions in early 2008, but that federal watchdog agency closed the investigation after the 48-year-old biologist died of sudden cardiac failure that spring. Since then, FC and Eath's widow Marquetta won a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, forcing the Forest Service to release scores of internal documents related to the case. Among other things, those records included emails from Forest Service legal counsel who disagreed with the disciplinary actions against Eath, and messages in which an employee relations chief recommended colleagues destroy emails related to the case. The OSC's decision to reopen its investigation was welcome news for Marquetta Eath.
Hopefully, the completion of Glenn's case will prevent anything like this happening again, that nobody else will have to experience what my husband Glenn was put through.
KFSK left messages for Forest Service officials, including Forrest Cole, on Friday, but the agency declined interview requests about the case through Alaska Region spokesman Ray Massey. Massey said the agency could not comment on an open investigation. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems, connecting your business and employees to the world through their high-capacity data network, bandwidth speeds up to 1,000 megabits per second, acsalaska.com.
Jeff King won the Copper Basin 300 sled dog race this afternoon, beating second-place finisher Alan Moore by 7 minutes. At the last checkpoint, King was only 2 minutes ahead of Moore, but King pulled away on the final 24-mile run to Telsana Lodge. Race manager Eric Lutz says it's always fun to watch the teams as they round the last corner and head to the finish.
Jeff King had a very impressive team. There's no doubt about it, and of course is very good at his craft. That's for sure.
Both King and Moore are past champions of the race. Lutz says this year it was hard to tell who was in the lead for much of the race, so many mushers were battling it out up front. He says it was tricky for officials to get the checkpoints open on time.
It was one of the hardest races for me to keep ahead of these guys this time because everybody had these unique racing strategies and what I thought was comfortable that everybody would stay at. Someone would break through and go on to the next checkpoint, and it was hopscotching like that throughout the whole race.
Rookie Josh Kadzow from Fort Yukon came in third. The race purse hasn't yet been set. The awards banquet will be held tomorrow evening in Glen Allen. The tribe that has been in Cook Inlet area for centuries has expanded educational programs they offer to their Kenaitse youth and the community. As part of our continuing series on Native education in South Central Alaska, KDLL's Ben Stanton reports even people that are not Kenaitse have become interested in preserving the tribe's culture and history by passing along those values to young people.
Kenaitse are Dena'ina, who are a branch of Athabascan Native Americans. Kenaitse number a little over 1,200 members who mostly live on the Kenai Peninsula and in Anchorage, but also across Alaska and in many parts of the lower 48. When nomadic Athabascans settled along rivers and near Cook Inlet hundreds of years ago, they named the area Yaganen, or the good land, or a safe place for the heart. Yaganen is now also the name given to the Kenaitse's Prevention and Early Intervention Program. There are many aspects of that program, but Yaganen coordinator Michael Bernard says that the program started nearly 20 years ago. One overarching theme is tobacco, alcohol, and drug prevention. They offer school tutoring, Native drum circle and dance, a Native youth Olympics team, and hunting and fishing as a way to have positive activities and influences, and learning.
And we teach them how to process the fish as a traditional manner as we can possibly give them. You know, of course, you know that traditions change and methods change, you know, so instead of going out with a spruce root net, which we can do, usually we'll go to the educational fishery net and teach them how to set net and bring fish in like that. So we have a wide variety of different things that we do with the youth.
Bernard is a certified teacher. He has degrees in anthropology and education. He describes himself as one quarter Alaska Native, although his family is not Kenaitse.
Nivagi Nushik and Shiizi and Nupeak Eshlanshida. That's Elda Nushugushakai Kalanda.
He says he's Inupiaq. His family moved to the central Kenai Peninsula in the 1970s. He grew up in Soldotna and became involved with the Kenaitse in his process of seeking a sense of place and finding it with the natives that have spent the most time here. Bernard's perspective, however, is that the point is not to look at values and principles as being native or non-native, but instead using those values to learn to be a good human being. He feels the Kenaitse education programs are maintaining that important element.
Taking care of your place that you live, taking care of your family.
He says the result is to build understanding of the traditions of honor and respect for both people and the environment. While Bernard says they look back to the history of the tribal culture, they also want to look forward.
Just in a simple belief, if we can teach the kids of today on what our native elders have passed on to this point, hopefully it'll open their minds and they'll have a different view on how they want their world to be in the future. And to me, I like to think that we're a part of that.
Applications for Kenaitse programs are available at the Education Services Building, a two-story log cabin in Old Town Kenai. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The National Park Service has opened a new museum in Kotzebue, and it features some interesting exhibits that highlight life in the Northwest Arctic. From member station KNBA, Jennifer Canfield has more.
There was a museum there before, but that one was private and charged a pricey entrance fee. So they tore the old one down and built a new one. And while this new one only takes up about 2,000 square feet of the building it's housed in, where it lacks in size, it makes up for in attention to detail. Chief of Interpretation Linda Jeske.
This is an umiak right here above us, and that was built by James McClellan, who is a local native elder in Kotzebue. So James put this together for us, and we're sitting underneath it in the way that people might have sat under a boat like this to have visits and meetings and talking.
And what about this spooky green light? Is that just for artistic effect?
It's for artistic effect. And they're trying to be reminiscent a little bit of Northern Lights and that sort of green shade that you get in the night sky in the middle of the winter.
That attention to detail is seen throughout the small museum. One exhibit evokes a feeling of modern art. Imagine a caribou, not a real one, of course. Now, imagine that caribou encased in a plexiglass cube up to its shoulders. Suspended in the cube, around the caribou's legs are fish. There's a bed of pebbles, and atop the plexiglass cube is made to look like a rush of water. It's something you'd have to see to believe, and you have to touch it to believe it's not real.
Those great exhibits, you see these in a lot of national parks. Denali has really phenomenal facilities like this. I mean, hard to hold a candle to them. But the Park Service is kind of in the business of creating things like this to try to tell those compelling stories.
Jeske says it was the work of elders from all of the villages in the Northwest Arctic Borough and interpretive artists who created the realistic landscape of the museum. The Saturday before Christmas was opening night. Jeske didn't expect a big crowd. She thought maybe only 50 people would show. But they stopped counting at 200. It was standing room only. The Northern Lights dancers performed, and people sang and danced all afternoon.
People seem to like it already. They seem to be taking some ownership of it.
Adjacent to the museum space is a room, about 1,000 square feet. It's for the community to use for whatever events they may be holding. Jeske says some people were surprised that the museum and the community space are both free to use and free to visit.
And now there's a place for people to come to when you have visitors in town or when you have extra time on your hands. There's a cool place to go.
The Northwest Arctic Heritage Center in Kotzebue opened in December. I'm Jennifer Canfield.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ben Stanton in Kenai, and Jennifer Canfield in Kotzebue. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.